You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh. Before we get started, I just wanted to remind you that this Sunday, November 6th at 7 p.m. is the first live episode taping of The Compass. You can get all the information on the Compass Podcast Facebook page. But if you're in New York, please come join us. My guests are going to be my husband, actor Frankie J. Alvarez, and actress and singer-songwriter Laura Gratmans. We're very excited and we're going to have a lot of fun. If you're not in New York City or you can't make it, the episode will be online to listen to next Friday, November 11th. My guest today is Carl Kensler. Carl is a wonderful actor, writer, director, and teacher. He and I met about a dozen years ago at the Chautauqua Summer Theater Program. He came to teach us a theater games class at that time when I was still in college. Since then, our shared orbits of both being University of Evansville alumni and New York City actors have kept us in touch over the years. I really admire his work, his generosity as an artist, the contagious energy he brings into a room, and I just love sitting down and talking with him about these big life questions. If you have a moment this week to give The Compass a rating, a review in iTunes, please do. It will help others to find the podcast. I hope you enjoy the 52nd episode of The Compass. So,
what do you do to try to keep from going to the dark side? What do I do to keep from going to the dark side? It's interesting. I actually try to, in a healthy way, embrace the dark side. It's so easy, I feel, in this business to separate myself from others. It can be a very lonely experience.
Yeah.
Especially when an actor is not working, an artist is not working. But recently I've been really interested in this idea of sitting with it. And I don't, it may just be that I've gotten older, but, you know, we're closing. I'm doing Fiddler on the Roof right now, and we close at the end of December, and I'm watching how everyone is responding to this closing notice, and it's really interesting that a lot of the younger people in the cast have immediately launched into, where's my next job? What am I doing? They're climbing a ladder. They're finding that next job, and I feel that as I've gotten older, it's less about finding that next job, and it's such a familiar place to be out of work when you're a freelancer, you know? And there's something, I always get a bit of a rush when I'm out of work. That first month or so, I feel just invincible. Like, I could do anything. I'll take that. I'll do that. I can do anything. I could book any job. And it doesn't always work that way, but I certainly feel that as I've gotten older, I have relished the idea of sitting with that rush of excitement, that
mixture of dread, anxiety, and possibility.
Yeah.
And I guess that's what I mean by sitting with the dark side, in terms of unemployment, in terms of being between jobs.
Yeah, what is the dark side for you in general?
I would say for me, the dark side is isolation. I talked about that loneliness. There is a, it's funny, when I was a kid, I was a very, very shy kid. And I grew up in a single parent household. And
do you have brothers and sisters?
I do. I have an older brother, he's 3 years older, and a sister who's 10 years older. And I was always kind of a dreamy kid. I was a very imaginative kid. I loved storytelling, I loved old movies, all that stuff. But I lived in my room a lot, and I lived in my head a lot, lived in my imagination. And I think that came out of, there was addiction in my household growing up, and there are mental health issues in my family, depression, bipolar, that kind of stuff. And I think my way of coping with that was to have this incredibly rich life inside my head. And I carry it with me even now. As an adult, I'm very much an introvert. But as an actor, I also can sort of turn that thing on. So I think it's a bit deceptive sometimes when I'm sort of on. But I'm very shy. And when I'm sort of sitting with that shyness and sitting with that isolation, that's when I go to the dark place that is really challenging. That sense of I'm different. My struggle is different from yours, Leah. My struggle is different from everyone's. You know?
Right.
Which is why finding this podcast, going out with friends, you know, they always say, like, oh, if you're unemployed, just go meet a bunch of other actors. You're going to hear the same story from, like, a dozen people.
But we all feel like we're the only one.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a kinship when we hear it from another.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I guess, to go back to the original question, that is how I, when I am my best self, that is how I embrace that darkness, is I realize that there is a kinship among all of us, which is interesting. I was talking to a former student of mine about why we act, and he said, I just love being in those worlds. And I felt very much the same way. It was something that I immediately identified with, that I know a lot of actors who sort of relish the sense of community, and I love that, but I think I'm a bit dysfunctional or broken or shy, and it's hard for me to sort of reach out like that. But what I truly, truly love is going into those, getting lost in those worlds, the world of story. And there is a, there's a connection there that I find is a safer, more structured connection.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that is what drew me to it in the first place, is growing up in an environment that wasn't safe. I could enter into someone else's narrative, have a connection with another human being that was true and honest and deep, and yet there was a structure to it that made it safer.
Yeah.
You know?
I know that's something when I'm doing a show that I really love, is like once you start it,
mm-hmm.
like those plays where if you don't have a lot of downtime in it, it's like, well, once we start, it's just going to keep going until it's over.
Yeah.
To ride out that story.
Yeah.
It's something I just love so much. I don't know if it is that safety of, like, I can't think about anything else right now. And it, it, inevitable is going to happen, and you're just in that story for the next 2 hours. It's something I really miss when I'm not doing a play.
Yeah, it's almost like there's a purity to it that I don't know if it's this way for you, but does your brain? I think my issue is that my brain is constantly teeming with distraction, with doubt, insecurity, worry. And so when I am purely engaged in my work, I just sit across from someone and we play a scene and there's that connection and all of the rest of it can fall away.
And especially, like, I assume it was this way for you with Peter and the Starcatcher, like a show like that where it's like ensemble and you're constantly having to go from like one thing to another, and it's just, you don't have a chance to...
You don't. It's interesting. It's interesting, but in a very...
No,
it's in a very different way. Starcatcher was interesting because people would constantly come to that show and they would say, oh, you guys must have so much fun. It looks so much fun. It's a celebration of theater and acting. But it was a kind of boot camp. And you, apart from, you know, Celia and Christian and Adam, there's not a lot of downtime to sit in a scene. A lot of those scenes are, you're booking through it. And there's a lot of technical stuff. Alex and Roger's direction was very precise. It was a lot of, I wouldn't say choreography, but it was that specific. And so it was a more physically taxing experience.
Than
mentally or emotionally. So the connections that were made were, they were still fun, but it was actor to actor as opposed to character to character. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I could sit across the stage and you know, turn a section of rope into a rolling ocean and look across at Greg Hildreth and we would be smiling going, oh my God, look what we're doing. But it wouldn't be like sitting across from you and doing, you know, Benedict and Beatrice. But that, it was thrilling because it was athletic, and Stephen Hoggett's choreography is just, I mean, what he does is so amazing of creating this union out of disparate performers, and the mechanics of it are just breathtaking, I think, in everything he does.
Where are you from?
I grew up in Indiana.
In Indiana.
Mm-hmm. I grew up in Indianapolis.
And then you went to Evansville.
I did. I went to the University of Evansville.
And then did you come right to NYU?
I took a year off, and I got my equity card at Indiana Repertory Theater. Yeah. And
I've done A Christmas Carol there.
Have you?
In the past.
I did the first year of that.
Oh, yeah.
They created an upper stage company of young local actors.
It must have been, I mean, 2011, 2012, something like that.
Yeah. I do. I love that theater, and I think
it's a beautiful theater.
It is. But that's where it was my first real professional union gig. And then I came to NYU. And the reason I took the year off after college was I used to have this very severe, like Bruce Springsteen underbite, like very, very, very protruding lower jaw. And I had to have surgery before I went to graduate school. I guess the way it was explained to me is that your upper jaw grows only because your lower jaw presses against it and sort of compels it to continue growing. And my lower jaw was growing down and out, so the upper jaw was not following suit. So just to get...
Did you audition? I mean, from college, or did you know that you had to wait?
I did audition, and then I asked them if I could defer for a year. And so when I showed up to NYU, I was about 4 weeks out of surgery where they had broken my lower jaw and cut a section out of it. Then they broke my upper jaw and took a bone graft out of the right side of my pelvis and built cheekbones for me and moved my upper jaw forward.
Do you have PTSD from this?
No, but if you look at an x-ray of my head, you can still see screws in
my
skull. It's pretty awesome.
And then you moved to New York City.
I moved to New York, and I had my jaw had been wired shut for like 2 weeks No, actually, it was almost 4 weeks that it was wired shut, and I had lost something ridiculous, like 20 pounds. So I showed up to New York. I was so skinny. My face was still so swollen that if I brought my hand towards my nose, I would touch my lips before I touched my nose. And I showed up at NYU, and I basically said to Deborah Hecht, speech teacher there, I was like, I need help learning to speak again. This is so interesting. I was just listening this morning to, do you know Stephen Fry?
Yes.
Yeah. He has this, incredible, episode on, iTunes. It's a podcast episode where it's called Word World or something like that. He's talking at an Apple store about language. And, he talks about how the human mouth, the tongue has such perfect memory. Your mouth moves so specifically, and your tongue is all over the place in there. If you have the tiniest obstruction, something in your teeth, a cracked tooth, like a swelling somewhere, it really screws everything up, right? Like when you just, if you just have a canker sore on the tip of your tongue, it grossly affects the way you talk. And so I had that like times 1,000. I had terrible jaw tension, and it was a really interesting way to introduce myself to New York, because I was kind of a big fish in a small pond at the University of Evansville. I was a little bit cocky, full of myself, and then smash, my jaw gets busted. I'm suddenly skinny with a head like a lollipop, and I show up, and I had to kind of learn it all over again. And I think that's where I really sort of developed this appreciation for language, for the spoken word. I mean, as an actor, as a college student, I had always been interested in storytelling and the spoken word and stuff, but I was coming at it from a more emotional place, you know what I mean? And then I got to NYU, and I had this technical training where I realized what a tremendous gift language is. I mean, it's kind of a miracle that you and I can sit across from each other and even have an inkling of what the other one is thinking, right?
Well, and also, too, because when everyone starts grad school, you don't realize, you don't realize, like, how much you need to start from the beginning and learn. Mm-hmm. I feel like I remember our speech teacher being like, you're saying Ben should be Bin. Like something had been.
Yeah.
I had been at the store and it's like, no, it's Bin. Like, oh, my whole life I thought I'm from Michigan. I said it that way. But you don't realize, and you came in, maybe it was helpful to you that you came in knowing that you needed to start from the beginning.
Yeah, I guess it was. I mean, it was also incredibly, I felt incredibly vulnerable. I guess maybe it was easier because I sort of had an excuse that like, look at this guy's mouth.
His defenses are down already.
Yeah, yeah. And you're right. Everyone was sort of going through it. You reach that level of training in anything and you basically show up to be informed.
but to realize, like, what you can achieve with hard work, too.
Yes.
Like, how amazing language is, but also what you can really do if you focus and devote yourself to the intricacies of what your tongue does.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess, I mean, to go back to this notion of the dark side, and again, it's interesting that isolation, to me, is so much the culprit of where that comes from. That feeling of not being plugged into the rest of your community or the rest of humanity it has so much to do with language and communication. And, I mean, whatever that language is, it can be spoken word, it can be the language of touch, it can be anything. But it is about finding that connection to your group, your people, your tribe, you know?
Do you feel a little differently about the isolation since having children? This just occurred to me, just because then, I mean, I know it's a different kind of relationship, but you're just constantly around.
It is different.
It's still a mental isolation.
It is. I think time-wise, there's less time to reflect on it. I think I said when I showed up that I was nervous when we first talked about doing this. And I think the reason why is that I listened to some of the episodes and I thought, oh, how do I deal with the dark side? And I realized I haven't really given it much thought in the last 5 years, because 5 years ago I had my first child. And there is something to do. Having an unfettered life means that I can reflect on it a bit more. I'm at a point in my life where I am a spouse, I am a father, I am a child to an aging parent who requires more attention than was required previously. And as a result, I have very, very little time to consider my own, I won't say needs, but my own desires. And I'm surrounded a lot at work by younger artists who do have much more freedom in their time and their energies to devote to projects. And I find that as I get older, I have to be a bit more selective about where I want to put my time and energy. Part of that is responsibility. Part of that is I'm responsible to my family, my wife, my kids. But a big part of it is also that, I don't know, man. What we do can't compare to watching a human being come into existence.
Yeah.
It's fucking awesome. I remember we got pregnant with my daughter when we were doing Peter and the Starcatcher down at New York Theater Workshop. And Alex Timbers said to me, and this is just when, like, Timbers was just blowing up, like, he was like, hey, man, explain to me what it is. You're so excited about being a dad. Explain to me what that is. And I started to tell him, I said, it just is really thrilling to just see these little sonograms and realize that, like, a human is starting here. And I said, it kind of gives the lie to everything we do in the theater. Like it's real what we do, but it's so not as real as the real, you know? And as I was saying it to him, he was like, yeah, he was kind of engaged, but he also was kind of like, his eyes sort of wandered off. And I was like, of course you're not there. And you shouldn't be there, because you're about to explode. And, like, you know, he's
focusing on different things.
Yeah. But I did realize soon after that, when my daughter was born, I noticed that as an actor, as a writer, as a teacher, I was constantly going to her for examples, because she's a person, but she's kind of a person in primary colors. She's five. So there's more shading that's getting on her as she gets older. But right now it's kind of easy to sort out what she's on about, you know? Emotionally, when she goes through something, it's with the big brush. She's a terrible liar because she's five, you know? But she's also so front-footed about it, in the same way that she's front-footed about when she says, you know, I love you infinity and miles, which makes perfect sense. But that is something that, as far as the dark side, I'm thrilled to spend time with her, to spend time with my son, to spend time with my family. And then there are times when I have such a longing for the other creativity. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I guess it's a question of finding the balance of, like, for the last 5 years, have you been less aware of, you know, the personal, mental, emotional struggles because it's taking you outside of yourself and you don't have time to focus on it? Or has one been a ignoring them or pushing them down. And I guess that depends on the little maintenance things you do for yourself along the way, whether you're letting something build up, or you're like, no, I'm actually dealing with it in a good way and healthy. And
you know, and I don't know. I mean, because here's what I will say is... I'm
not sure if that makes sense.
No, it makes total sense. And I think it's a question of...
Because I've heard other parents say in a great way where I'm like, I want that. Where like, oh, well, since I had my kid, the stress of auditioning, all of these other things, they just don't matter as much. I just go in, I do it, and then I get back to keeping this tiny human alive.
That is absolutely true.
Which sounds wonderful.
It does. Because you kind of go, yeah, whatever. All right, yeah. Fine.
Stress I put myself through around auditioning.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. I was told once this wonderful thing that before you have children, if you don't have children, 90% of your life is about yourself and 10% is about other human beings. So when you go to that soup kitchen and you ladle up the soup, it's awesome. And it's 10% of your life. When you have children, 90% of your life is about other people and 10% is about yourself. And it doesn't feel as glorious to give to the others because you're just constantly giving.
Yeah.
But there are flashes of bliss where you just realize that it's all worth it. And the 10% of time that you have for yourself, the 10% of time that I have for myself, it goes back to the thing, I have to be just a bit more selective. I can't do every reading. I can't commit myself to projects that don't make me money unless I'm truly passionate about them. You know, I worked with a couple of friends from U of E, college friends, Chris Gerson and Carrie Preston, and a friend of ours, Lynn Rosen, the playwright Lynn Rosen. And we created this online series called Darwin,
yes.
Darwin the Series. And we've been working on that for like 4 years. It was truly a labor of love, and it was a ton of time that we spent and a good portion of our own money and raising money. But we did it, and it's a beautiful story, and it's funny, and we've got just some tremendous actors involved, and the writing is wonderful. Lynn's writing is so spiky and funny and weird, and Carrie's direction is just beautiful, and it's something that I'm so proud of because it's something that I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, and as actors, we spend so much time being interpretive artists and waiting to be told that we can, you know what, you can do this. Go ahead and do this now. There's
or
something.
Or you get to do this.
Yeah, yeah.
Aren't you lucky? What were you guys going through when you came up with the idea, when you started working on it?
And actually, it's funny. We started with a completely different idea that was going to require a lot more money and stuff, and we had the name already, Darwin the Series, and then we realized it was just too big. We weren't going to be able to do it, and I said, "Oh, I had a really interesting idea about I like the idea of the public versus private." Because I'm so much like that. I very often project an image out into the world that I'm cool, everything's fine, I'm good. And inside, I am a fucking train wreck.
Yeah.
Just desperately trying to keep it together, right? And what if we have a guy who is that and is in a position of authority? He's a therapist or a life coach or something. And we hit on that idea and I said he should have a client who seems like a train wreck, but is actually just a really solid, decent, good person, you know? And we brought Lynn into it, and the three of us just sort of brainstormed on it. We wanted there to be a wife involved, because we were also... I was a new parent, Lynn had two kids, and we thought it was interesting to write a story about... So much of the online stuff is about people in their 20s, and we thought it would be interesting if we wrote about another stage of life. And so Celia Keenan-Bolger came in, and she played Leo's wife, Charlie. But the impetus for that actually came from the fact that Chris Gerson and I met in college, and I was dating someone, and Chris came in and there was a bit of a love triangle thing for a while. We sort of argued over the same girl. And that became the impetus for sort of the love triangle tension in it. And
but also you just wanted to work together.
Yeah. Chris and I had been talking about doing something. We used to shoot videos with a giant VHS brick of a camera in college. And Carrie had a production company with a friend from Juilliard, and she'd already produced and directed a few films, and she wanted to do something where she didn't produce. So we sort of pulled it all together, and it's also that sense of community. I mean, I'm such a weird, awkward 9-year-old inside that to get a chance to work shorthand with people that I love and respect is just awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and I think that's maybe something that we all long for. It's something that, you know, the notion of being part of a rep company or being in a graduate school or a college setting where you have people that you work with and you can get to a place a lot quicker because you know them. You trust each other, so you can get in there really deep, right?
Yeah.
That is where that came from.
And that made producing work that you had to do worth it.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's also interesting to sort of find out where your skill sets may lie. We didn't, I'd never produced anything before, and but we found, oh, I'm good at this. I'll do this part.
Are you guys making more?
We are. We're working on it's really interesting. It's so fast moving. New media is so fast moving. When we started writing the scripts for this, we were going to write 22-minute episodes, like TV, right?
Right.
By the time we were shooting, we had to chop those 22-minute scripts up into, we were shooting for something around 5 or 6 minutes a piece. By the time we released it, people were not wanting to watch anything more than a couple minutes long. And now it's almost impossible to get people to watch anything that's over a minute long because we now watch it on our phones.
Mm-hmm.
So people are watching it while they walk or while they're on the subway or sitting at a cafe. And so we're doing a new season that is, we're trying to do 1-minute episodes.
The new thing is like Instagram.
Yeah. Yeah, but what we want to do, the clever thing that I'm very excited about is the pieces that we're fitting into the puzzle fit in around the existing narrative. So it's like a minute with one character who's off camera during another scene. It's what's happening to them while that's happening. So that hopefully you can watch that and go, and they may intersect with something else and you'll go, oh, let me go back and watch that.
I haven't watched the entire series yet. I really love the music.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, yeah.
Cool.
We pulled a lot. We bought rights for a lot of stuff, but we also used a guy named Alex Savronsky, who wrote stuff for the finale. He does a lot of he writes a lot of music for classical theater, for Shakespeare plays and stuff.
Did you ever see that series, short-lived series, Pushing Daisies?
Yes.
It kind of reminded me of the use of music in that, like where it's kind of this fantastical soundtrack for parts of the story.
Yeah, I really love that kind
of
stuff.
It highlights the dual world, like you said, private and public.
Yeah, I think we were also kind of, without being derivative, we were drawing from things like Wes Anderson and Junet and Caro, the guys who did Amelie and City of Lost Children. That I like that. I mean, I just sort of the way I grew up. I love the sort of melancholy underbelly. I really like it. Gives a sort of weight to even the silliest stuff when it comes from a kind of a desperate hunger, you know, a desperate need. And I really like that kind of stuff. So I think that's what we were kind of going for, was a person who's kind of imploding and working so hard to not let you see that, which is, you know, a very personal story for me.
Can I ask you about teaching? Is it still a big part of your life? And do you find that it fuels you artistically, or is it more of a, you know, I need a side hustle and
It's not, you know, it started as a side hustle. It's funny.
Because that's how I first met you, was when you came to Chautauqua to teach.
Yeah.
Class.
Yeah. I love it so much, and I get a deep satisfaction from it that I don't even get from acting, which I think I was a little late to acknowledge. I think going back to that thing that when I was younger, I was so hungry to do whatever, to be successful in some way as an actor. And I remember I was offered a job to teach at NYU grad acting, and I didn't want to do it. I did not want to do it because I felt that it would be a failure on my part to take that on. But once I started to do it, I realized that it became like a practice, like a meditation practice for me, and it kept me so honest as an actor. Because if I'm going to do that and teach people how to do that thing, I better damn well be doing it myself. And I've always thought that what I teach isn't necessarily theater or an acting class, but my love for this came from a guy who taught me, a guy named Paul Walker, who was just an incredible teacher and a human being and an actor. And he taught me theater games at NYU. And I don't know how deep I want to go into this. I lived around the corner from him, and the first year that I was at NYU, he was diagnosed with AIDS. This was 91, okay? So it's kind of the height of it. And he lived for 3 full-blown years with full-blown AIDS. And my third year, final year at NYU, he was directing a play, a Dario Fo farce called We Won't Pay, We Won't Pay. Do you know it? It's so funny. It's so good. Talk about desperate hunger. It's like it's like the Honeymooners, an Italian version of the Honeymooners, except they're so poor and so hungry that they're willing to do anything to get by. And they are sort of held in place by this one actor who plays all these characters of authority, a policeman, a carabinieri. And he keeps coming in and sort of holding them down, and they have to, but it's just wicked, wicked farce, and physically just so athletic and fun, and the language is really chewy. And so Paul was directing this, and my third year, and the guy had been living, I lived around the corner from him, and a friend and I used to go over to his house and help him put in his medicine at night. And it made him desperately sick. Like he would get, I think it was AZT, he would get physically, violently ill. But he lived by this principle of accepting your given circumstances and leaning into it. And so I think more than any other experience I've had in my life, it moved me so profoundly. And this is not to take anything away from incredible teachers that I've had. But this guy lived it, you know, like 100%. And he was a good friend, and he was an amazing teacher. And the things that he taught, what he sort of got out of people in class, which it wasn't so much acting training, it was like just teaching you to be a better human, you know, to be present and to be engaged and interested and curious. And fearless. So,
and now that's what you go on.
And now that's what I like to, certainly there's a lot of us who sort of came through his teaching and are teaching, but in very different ways. Frank Diehl, who teaches at Juilliard, Dan Cordell, Antoinette LaVecchia, Kevin Isola, Danielle Skrostad, myself. There's a lot of people, and we all bring a different sort of take to it. But the thing that I've always really, really felt is that it is about teaching us to just be present and curious and not judgmental. So when I teach, acting, when I teach games, there's I work very hard to try to confound myself and everyone in the room and say, you have this preconceived notion about this. Well, what if it's the other? What if it's the other thing? What if it's not that? And I find very often when we step out of our comfort zone, it's when we're doing our best work as artists. So I love it. I haven't been doing it much recently because of the kids, but I was just saying recently that I'm desperate to get back into it because it gives me such great pleasure. And talk about combating the dark side. It's a it's an incredible way to plug into a shared humanity, you know?
And enjoy, too. I often think about, we had clown class at Juilliard, I think just for a semester, and I really wish that we had had it. I learned more from that class than from a lot of my other training. Like, the same thing as with games, it's like, it really makes you connect with those people in that room.
Mm-hmm.
In a different way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You can't be hiding. You just have to be open and go, and the joy and the innocence that can be in that was really beautiful.
Yeah, there's a lightness to it that that is... I also think is... I find when I teach, also, it's very common that young actors will mistake hard work for presence. And very often it's the exact opposite that is required. It's just showing up. That's it. And and it's the hardest thing in the world to just show up and not have an agenda, right?
I know how to do hard work.
Yeah, I know. And then you say, like, all you gotta do is show up. And they go, all right, I'm gonna show up. And they show up with such ferocity that...
I think it's because so much else is out of our control. So yeah. What else can you do except, I'm going to do as much homework as I can. I'm going to memorize these lines until they're dead. Like,
yeah.
Otherwise, yeah, you really do have to embrace that. That spontaneity and that unknown, because otherwise you're like, well, I don't have control over anything else, so I should be doing this.
Yeah. It's funny because it is... there is a... Once the rest of life starts to grab onto you and distract you, it goes back to the thing we were saying earlier about having other responsibilities. Yeah. I mean, honestly, that's the other thing I would say is, like, to combat the dark side, like, get involved in something else.
Yeah.
When I am involved in other things, things for my kids, things for my community, things with my neighbors, I'm not so twee or precious about my work. And holy hell, it's so much better. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there is, and that, I think that's just inevitable, you know? It's just inevitable that the more time you spend on the planet, the more you get dinged up and knocked around, and you just, it's like anything, you know, like a little tree starts to grow and it's just a little shoot that's coming up. But the more it grows, those roots stretch out, other things grab onto it, and it's just, you're connected to other stuff. And you can't be your gypsy artist self. For the most part, the longer you show up in the world, the more life gets its hooks into you, mm-hmm. You know? And there's such a sweet release in that.
Has there ever been a time when you thought about leaving New York or being based somewhere else?
Yeah. Often, actually. I think it's a very common actor fantasy of, like, well, hey, what would we do? What would I do if I chucked all this? We... My wife and I have talked about it.
And because your wife is not an artist.
She's not. No, my wife is she's an accountant, and she's also Polish. She was born in Poland, and she's incredible. Her learning curve for how to be with a working artist is she's been such a good student about it. And I know I'm a challenge. I know it. I know I am, and I apologize for it. But she's been very understanding about saying, well, of course you have to be someplace where you can do your work. And then I go into sort of dramatic flights of fancy about like, well, I could do my work anywhere. And it's just not true. I mean, I could, but it would be different work. And I like where we are. I think about leaving, but I also know that at this point in my life, I'm invested here. And for now, I like it here. I like it. I was thinking this morning about as I get older, there are certain doors that are closing. You know, there are doors and roles that I just won't play. And while it would be lovely to think that you can always change your life 100%, you can just chuck it all into there. Maybe it's the German side of me, maybe it's the Midwesterner in me, but I'm like, no, there comes a point where I do have a responsibility as a human on the planet to the people that I've chosen, you know, and the people I've made. So the challenge for me is not the choice is not to leave New York, but the choice is to find that joy and creativity in what I am doing. And as an actor, I sort of think about the it's in Camus' Stranger, where he talks about likening prison to being trapped in a tree trunk and only being able to look up and see a patch of sky. And he says it just sounds horrible, but eventually I'd adapt. And I would find the clouds passing beautiful.
That does sound like living in New York City.
It totally does. Totally does. If you even get that view.
It's normal, but to someone else,
yeah.
It would seem insane.
Yeah. But I really think it's taken a while to get to this, Leah, but I so want to talk about this. It really comes down to the story we choose, you know? I can look at my life in New York and say, like, oh, you know, I didn't get to play Hamlet. Oh, I didn't get to... But the reality is I've been doing this show. I've been doing Fiddler on the Roof for the last year. I play the constable, who's the bad guy. I don't sing or dance, but I get this wonderful opportunity. I get about probably 20, 25 minutes a night where I have these one-on-one scenes with Danny Burstein, who plays Tevye, and it is so fun. Those 25 minutes a day are so much fun because he is. And I'll tell you what, he is so game. And we have been allowed to have a pretty broad path. So every night, our relationship is very, very different. And it's always surprising. And it's always fun. And we find the jazz in and around that melody line that we have to play to tell the story. And we've been doing it for a year. And part of that job is a grind, but man, those 25 minutes every night are creatively so fulfilling. And that's what I'm talking about. You may be trapped in a tree trunk, but if you're paying attention, if I pay attention, I'm finding that blue sky, I'm finding those clouds. And do you know a poet named John O'Donohue? Do you know him? He's an Irish. He died, I think, like maybe 10 years ago. But he's an Irish poet and philosopher, and he talks a lot about beauty in the world and how we have a choice. He said, "You have a choice when you walk out your door. You have to choose whether or not you're walking out into a dead landscape or whether you're walking into a vibrant place filled with beauty. And it's so true, especially when you live in a place like New York City. It's very easy to see nothing but the garbage and the puddles and the despair and the misery. But if you're paying attention, you also hear that cricket every night in the construction site as I leave the theater. There's a cricket that hangs out. And for the last, like, 5 days, I stop and I listen to him at, like, 11 o'clock at night. And he's there. I don't know what the lifespan is of a cricket, but he's been going at it. And I'm like, there's a cricket in the middle of New York City. That's like a kid's story. It's amazing. But he talks a lot about that, about true beauty, which is not magazine and glamour. Cover. It's not glamour. It's not, glamour is a trick. Yeah. It's true beauty. And I think when I tune my lens to that, it's another way of plugging in. It's another way of seeing the creativity, seeing the joy, seeing the beauty of my life. And that keeps me from going to the dark side. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wanted to ask, since you've had the luck of doing a lot of like long runs in the theater, what are some things that you've learned about? What are the things that are hard, and what are the things that you've learned to help you get through doing the same story for a year or 2 years? To keep yourself feeling creative when maybe it feels like getting stuck or something.
I think, let's see, that's a really good question.
I haven't done it, but I'm curious.
Yeah. And I mean... It is a different set of skills. And it's actually, I think it is, unfortunately, it's one of the challenges of living in a capitalist society where we aren't well subsidized to the point where, especially if something is going to reach a broad audience on the stage, it needs to be popular. And if it is popular, it's not just true in theater. It happens in television, it happens in film franchises. You just keep going till you squeeze every dollar out. Now, that in and of itself is neither good nor bad. It falls to me as a person working on a show like that to keep it alive. And when we close Fiddler, it'll be a year. I did Mary Poppins on and off for 4 years. And I will say this about that. My bosses at Disney Theatricals were awesome to me. They were really lovely in the sense that they allowed me to leave and recharge my batteries twice. They let me leave and go do Peter and the Starcatcher and come back. They let me leave and go do the first season of House of Cards and come back.
That's amazing.
And that's the upside of having a popular big show like that, where they had in the pipeline enough guys who had played my role either on the tour or that they were able to, I was able to leave for 3 months and they were able to have someone step in and fill that role for me. The downside of that is that it can very easily start to become like just your job.
Yeah.
And I have seen that happen in myself and in shows that I've seen. I personally try to be very careful about that because I do as much as I want to be light and joyful about it, I think I take what I do very, 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 very seriously. And I think of it as something that is inherently connected to my integrity as a human. So I can be sometimes humorless about screwing around on stage and the little things that are done and, you know. Yeah, and I do... Yes, absolutely. I do think that the danger is that we always have a blind spot, and I think the joy of doing a role like that, I played George in Mary Poppins, and it was a wonderful script. It was written by Julian Fellowes. You had the Sherman Brothers music. I got to meet Dick Sherman and Dick Van Dyke, and it was just a wonderful, like, sort of like, just my childhood just washing over me again. But I also got to tell this story of a man who was overworked and not paying attention to his family. And at that time, I became a father during the course of the run of that play. So it had a profound effect on me. So I was very careful to tell that story honestly. The downside about doing it for that long for me was that sometimes I would get a little... I would go down a road a little too far. The great thing about playing a character on and off for 4 years is I got to sit with that guy and know him really, really well. And there were times where I could literally focus on one aspect of his personality, and that would get me through a month. I remember at a certain point, I really focused on him being incredibly distracted, just always thinking of something else. So I always sort of got to play with that idea of, I'm talking to you, but I'm worried about this. I'm talking to you. I remember I got carried through for months on this notion that that George found Mary Poppins attractive and that it made him desperately uncomfortable. And so that was really fun to be able to play that for a while. Yeah. And it didn't become the defining thing, but it gave me a place to put my attention so that I didn't wander. The danger in that is you can go too far in that and do the thing where I'm working hard instead of just showing up.
You're telling too much of a different story.
Yeah. 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 They're like, who's that creepy old dude with the nanny? But it was wonderful. You know, it was wonderful to be able to do that. It's, but it is tricky. It is very tricky to keep something like that alive.
I know we talked about this a little bit earlier with like reaching out to friends and things like that, but are there any other concrete things that you reach for on a day where you're really feeling like you're in the dark place?
Food, painkillers. It is funny. I have like issues of addiction in my own life, and I grew up with it. So I'm kind of hyper aware of that, and I try to the things that I am. I try to push myself towards interests that are healthy. Right. Because I know by now that I have an incredibly addictive personality. Right. My phone is the bane of my existence. My wife is constantly telling me, don't bring it to bed. I fall asleep and with it in my hand every night.
You mentioned a couple of poets. Are there things that you go back to and reread?
I do. You know, I'm really into this guy, John O'Donohue. I find his language really dense. He's almost like James Joyce. If you get a chance, you have to listen to him. He has some audiobooks on iTunes.
Oh, cool.
And if you just Google his name in an iTunes podcast search, you'll find he's been on Being with Krista Tippett. I love it too. Oh man, yeah. She's amazing. That's when I go to. Yeah. But yeah, John O'Donohue, he has a beautiful voice, and it's much easier for me to understand him when he's speaking than when he writes. When he writes, I feel like I can just go over the same page again and again and again, and it's like reading Joyce.
With Irish writers, the Irish tradition is so based in vocal story.
Yes, absolutely. You know, when I came out of grad school, I got a Fox Fellowship, and I went and studied storytelling in Ireland for 3 months.
Oh my gosh.
And that idea, that notion of the oral tradition, the notion of repeating things 3 times, that there's like a magic to that. Mm. I mean, it's based in the Trinity, but it's also just smart storytelling. You say something 3 times, it's going to stick with people. And so why not make it a ritual? Why not make it a bing, bing,
yeah.
Bing?
No, it makes sense that you hear his poetry differently if he's saying it than if you're reading it.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, that I'm music. I wish I read more. I mean, the truth is, it's the damn phone and kids that like. It's hard for me to go back to commit myself to a book, but I'm trying to push myself towards healthy interests. I listen to Krista Tippett. I've been reading a lot of John O'Donohue. I'm very interested in Stephen Fry. I think I mentioned him earlier. He has a series of like audiobooks called English Delight, where he just sort of picks apart language. And I just think he's such a smart guy. And I also hear a lot of. I connect with him a lot because he's bipolar and he's dealt with depression and but he's an incredibly intelligent, engaged, passionate human. Music, I love listening to when I'm really feeling scattered. I listen to Bach because it's so mathematical. And I feel like it helps just put things into place, yeah, for me. It's like I can rebuild myself a little bit with it.
I don't know if you've really had the chance to see anything recently since you're in a show, but I was going to ask if you have anything to recommend.
That's the question that I dreaded the most when you said that.
It's understandable that you're a little busy at 8 p.m.
I haven't seen. Well, it's not just work too. It's also that when we've had nights off and people will say, "Come see this," I get to see my kids so rarely that we've been watching a lot of TV. But I would say, as far as theater, the last thing that I saw that really knocked me out, and it was like 3 years ago, but it kind of changed things for me. And it may sound a bit cliche. Was I saw Sleep No More very, very early on.
Yeah, me too.
And the experience I had was so... I don't even know how to explain it. Because I don't want to ruin it for anybody who hasn't seen it. But basically what happened is I connected with one character the entire night. And I found her early on. She sent me away on a task. I came back to her. She sent me away for something else. And so the whole 3-hour experience for me was my relationship to the character of Hecate.
Oh, cool.
And I'm not going to lie to you. Like, I fell in love with that actress. Like, and it ended with this very intense one-on-one thing in a private room that culminated, without spoiling too much, with her doing something that was... she picked me up and started laughing and spinning me around the room in this dark sort of Victorian room.
Oh my goodness.
And then pushed me through a curtain that had a door and pushed me out of the room, and then the door closed, and it was like it had never happened. It was like waking up from a dream. And she had recited this, I don't want to go into too many details if I haven't seen it, but like she recited this poetry to me and served me a cup of tea, and it was so... It was such a perfect melding of watching a play and being in a play.
Yeah.
And
I don't think you're ruining anything, because everyone's experience is different.
Like, yeah.
I don't think I had any one of those one-on-one rooms or anything when I went, but I still had an amazing time.
Yeah, I've told people every time friends of mine come to the city, I'm like, if you like to look in someone's medicine cabinet when you go to their house, you're gonna love this play. But it changed things for me that I really feel like that is, in a weird way, it put a piece of the puzzle in for me, and I thought, that's what we've all been trying to do for thousands of years, is have that kind of a connection. And I know there's been this proliferation of these immersive theater pieces, and some are amazing and some aren't, but I'm so excited for it. And Marla, who you know, we was one of the dancers in our show in Finland.
Yeah, she was in it for a while. Yeah.
Yeah. And we talked a lot about, because I'm working on this adaptation of Romeo and Juliet right now for TACT, for the Actors Company Theater. And I was saying to her, I want that. I want that immersive theater. I don't necessarily want to do immersive theater, but how do you get that connection with an audience without having them walk through your room? How, there's got to be a way to bring them closer.
Well, I think an interesting thing about that particular show is also the anonymity, that you're wearing these masks.
Yeah.
I think that changes it too.
Oh, that's a really good point. That's, yeah, because it frees us up to
feel more free and...
Yeah. It is, theater is a communal experience, but it's also a singular experience. And, you know, when we're doing, when we were working on Darwin, I kept saying, the thing we have to remember in writing this story is that most people who watch this are going to watch it alone, which is very different than going to a movie theater or even watching TV.
Yeah.
Because when you hold it on your phone or on your iPad, there's not a lot of room for another person. Usually, you don't, I wouldn't include you in it unless I watched it first and said, this is amazing, Leah has to see it. And it's a very different thing to watch something on your own. You access a very different part of yourself.
That's interesting.
And that's that, the thing you just said about wearing those masks, that's fascinating to me. Because as an audience member in just a regular traditional play, you're in that sort of shadow space between. You get to be by yourself in a dark room, but you also are reassured by others. And I don't know, I feel like maybe there's a continuum there where like...
Yeah, you're trying to marry the two.
Yeah, and Marla said a very interesting thing. She said when you perform, when she performs as a dancer normally, it's about extending yourself to your audience. But what they talk about at Punch Drunk is it's about inviting the audience to come to you.
Hmm.
Which I thought is an interesting point of view.
Well, and it makes them have to be active.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah, yeah. It does.
You can't sit back.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you can, but then you'll spend your night going through the medicine cabinet. Yeah. So, Yeah.
This is wonderful. I feel so bad that I have to go to work today, or I could just keep talking to you.
That's forever. No, please. I'm sorry. I feel like I was kind of all over the map.
Oh, this is wonderful. Yeah. Well, guys, go see Fiddler if you can before December. It's so good.
Yeah. And go watch DarwinTheSeries.com.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you, Leah.
For listening to the Compass podcast, I'm Leah Walsh. More episodes are coming soon. Please look for us on Facebook and iTunes. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller, music by Brendan Spieth, audio assistance from Nick Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.